It is the Mind and Fitness Podcast for Thursday, March the 13th, 2025. Let's get into it. Now, I struggled about what I wanted to play this week. I had a thought about maybe playing a podcast between Christy Wiepe and I from the week that was the COVID week, where everything shut down, which was 5 years ago this week. I've replayed that interview before, so I opted out of that. But if you'd like me to replay that at some point soon, maybe give me a shout. Maybe that's something for April. I'm going to New York and DC with the family in April. And so for that week that I'm gone, I'll need to put something up. And so maybe that is the thing that I do at that point in time. But nevertheless, we're going to do another couple of episodes with Dr. Hanscom. A few weeks ago, we recorded and then we recorded again. So I'm going to drop a couple of 20-minute dimes for you. And we'll get started with this week's, with part one. But before I get started with that, I wanted to thank the patrons of the show. If you're interested in supporting the podcast, there are about 24 people that come and support the website, support the podcast every single month. It's patreon.com/themindandfitnesspodcast. I'm going to give a shout out to Barb. It has been over 7 years, 7.5 years that Barb and Arnie have both been here supporting the show. And I'm so grateful for you two. Sarah and Brian and Julie, Christina, Michael, Tony, Irina, Jason, John, Dominic, Elise, Deborah, Julie, Jeff, Albert, Teresa, Mary, and Justin. You're all continuing to show up, support the show. Can't thank you all enough for all of that. So, this week and next week, it's going to be my interview with Dr. Hanscom from the end of February. We talked about the survival response. He touched on FOMO. Ooh, my voice. He touched on FOMO, which is interesting because I have a lot of FOMO in my life over a lot of things, and indecisiveness, and we get into that. And I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correctly. Schadenfreude, I think. We talk about complex consciousness. So there's a lot of good stuff in here over the next couple of weeks. So we dive a little bit further into the DOC journey, the DOC, Direct Your Own Care journey, to help solve the problem of stress physiology. We're kind of picking up on that stuff that we were talking about a couple of months ago. So without further ado, let's listen to part one with Dr. Hanscom and I. Welcome back to the Mind and Fitness Podcast. As always, this is your host, Eddie Lindenstein. Back again. It's been a few weeks. But Dr. David Hanscom is back here. We've got a few things that we want to chat about. You're continuing to write a book. This is your third book, is that right?
Well, it's my fourth book. I wrote two editions of Back in Control, and a spine surgery book. And then you know, this thing called the DOC Journey, Direct Your Own Care Journey, which is essentially the third edition of my Back in Control. And I wrote the book on Do You Really Need Spine Surgery? And I swore I was never going to write another book because it's a pretty all-encompassing process. But I sort of, I'll use the word accidentally stumbled across this concept or this situation where most people have more unpleasant, disturbing thoughts than they would like. Just things like, I'm not good enough, I'm a fraud, nobody likes me, I don't like certain parts of my body. I mean, you get these repetitive thoughts in your brain that aren't horrible, but they just keep spinning around and keep spinning around. And the research shows that the mental pain is actually less tolerated than physical pain because we have no withdrawal response. So what I've inadvertently found out that these are considered unsolvable by the mental health world. And I, through a lot of trial and error, including my own experience, have found that they are solvable. As we talked about last time, the driving force behind these thoughts is the physiology. Your fight or flight physiology drives these thoughts because your thoughts reflect your internal body's your body's internal chemical state. So if you're stressed, your thoughts are flying out like crazy. And so then the thoughts themselves create their own stress. So you get these endless repetitive thought patterns that simply part of the human experience. If you come from a really tough family background, these thoughts can just be really miserable. Some people sort of a nuisance, but more of an intense high-level person you are, the worse the problem, but also more of a well-intentioned person you are, the problem. Because people that are less well-intentioned don't give much meaning to these thoughts. What happens if you take these thoughts personally, it's a big problem. So what I've found out this last literally 3 weeks, which is it is disturbing just because how devastating it has been on the human experience. But this is a human experience problem that, okay, we have human consciousness. It's complex. My cat has a lot of consciousness. She thinks, she makes decisions, she acts accordingly to survive, but she doesn't have that cognitive construct with deep abstract thinking. She's not planning wars, she's not planning dates, she's not planning a wedding. You know, she just goes about her business and takes care of things. She assesses things, and she knows me, she knows my wife separately, but she doesn't have that complex consciousness. Well, this complex consciousness creates a lot of havoc because there's two parts to who we are as humans. There's this survival physiology, anxiety and anger, what we call Schadenfreude. We'll talk about that in a second. Then that's a million times stronger than your conscious brain, which is actually who you are. But if you're constantly fighting your stress physiology, which, by the way, is not going away, we would not survive without it, you're losing. You're losing the battle, plus your brain's on that direction, and you go progressively deeper and deeper into a deep hole. You're not getting rid of anxiety. You're not getting rid of anger. You would not stay alive, right? So why fight them? So what you do, you learn to separate yourself from these survival reactions, and then as a separate skill set, you nurture joy, spirituality, good food, good wine, good friends. But what happens, unless you understand how to regulate your stress physiology, with the first step being not taking it personally, then you're sort of doomed to do whatever you can do to decrease your pain. So there's three things that happen in the human experience that really drive repetitive and pleasant thoughts. It's a little bit more complex than that, but I just like to talk about this one process called Schadenfreude. And what it is a German term for having pleasure by observing somebody else's suffering. And this made no sense to me ever. Why have people historically gone to public burnings, hangings, shootings, lynchings, look at incredibly violent things? It always draws a crowd. Why does that happen? Mm-hmm. And what happens is you observe somebody else's suffering. There's a bunch of things that happen, but the basic ones that light up your pleasure circuits. So you actually have less pain by watching somebody else's suffering. You follow me on this one?
Is this, I think I know what you're going to say. Is this a universal experience, meaning this is for everybody? Or is this like, because when you say that, I think of like, you know, Ted Bundy or Dexter or, you know, people throughout history that are serial killers or sociopaths. Or is it just that this is a, pretty much everybody has it?
Everybody has it.
Okay.
Now, if you're a sociopath, and I'll explain this in a second, it's a well-meaning people that have more troubles with repetitive thought patterns and people just act out on them. Now, we're suppressing unpleasant thoughts and emotion actually eventually causes a lot of repetitive thoughts, a lot of anxiety. You get crippled with anxiety, depression. And the problem is well-meaning people give more meaning to these dark survival sensations. So anxiety, anger are incredibly dark. My cat kills a mouse or a bird, she doesn't care. Tiger kills, you know, an antelope, tiger doesn't care, right? So we have all these morals formed by our human consciousness that a lot of people that are sociopaths don't really concern about. So these sensations are incredibly dark, despicable, bizarre, disgusting, disturbing, but they're just sensations. They're survival sensations that evolved to be incredibly dark because they keep you alive. Mm-hmm. So then what happens, we confuse our identity with these survival sensations. And this is where I think the human race has actually not figured this out. So we have these dark survival sensations. We do what it takes to stay alive. We are here, right? And so what's happening, emotional pain is processed in a similar manner as physical pain. We cannot escape our thoughts or emotions, so we suppress them, which makes things even worse. So what happens if you're a well-meaning person, you have this dark sensation, you give a lot of meaning to it, and then for me personally, I came from a very abusive background, and I spent my life building ideals, I'm a good person, compassionate, creative, all this different stuff. So you built a veneer or an identity or an ego based on trying to feel better about yourself in light of these dark sensations. Mm-hmm. It takes a tremendous amount of mental energy and a major source of repetitive, unpleasant thoughts. But what happens, though, most of your ego identity is actually built on cognitive distortions. It's sort of bizarre. So you want people to like you, you want to be a people pleaser, you want to accomplish this, this, and this. And when you define yourself by your experiences and accomplishments and your intelligence or looks or whatever it is, there's no end point because you still cannot outrun these dark emotions. No chance. So what's happening, which I think is disastrous for the human experience, is that we have this thing called Schadenfreude, that when you watch somebody else suffer, your pain goes down. Think about it.
And to be clear, you could be talking about mental pain, emotional pain, any pain.
Any pain.
Okay.
Any pain. And the other thing is, when I also found over the years that people can't actually tell much difference between physical and mental pain. So when you ask people if they want to get rid of their mental pain or the physical pain, almost everybody says they can't tolerate the anxiety. They can sort of deal with the physical pain, but the anxiety is just relentless. And again, the anxiety also comes in the form of these repetitive, unpleasant thoughts, which don't stop. There's a direct link between these, what I call ruts, repetitive, unpleasant thoughts, and suicide. Other mammals don't commit suicide like humans do. So these things just drive you right into the ground. So if you think about this carefully, look at the human experience. Okay, so you have ongoing pain. You cannot escape your thoughts. Every human being has some level of discomfort from these thoughts. And so what do? You watch other people get hurt. Mm-hmm. It lowers your pain. What are the alternatives? I mean, there's plenty of alternatives, but we're not really taught these things. Right? Think about it.
Yep.
So then what happens? Okay, so there's three parts to this. The first one is envy. Okay? So if you're jealous or envy or have FOMO, fear of missing out, what happens, that actually lights up the pain circuits. So Schadenfreude occurs to somebody you consider an equal or competitor or higher than you. And that sense of Schadenfreude occurs when somebody who is higher than you goes down. But from a survival standpoint, you have less competition for resources. It's automatic. It's hardwired. It's just like anxiety and anger. You can't control it. So then you have this surge of joy, and I'm a good person. I spent my life convincing myself that I'm okay. I don't really have Schadenfreude. And 2 weeks ago, I never would have admitted to you that I have Schadenfreude. I mean, what a disgusting emotion or thought, right?
Mm-hmm.
We all have it. You have it. I have it. I wasn't connected to it. I really, anytime a little twinge of that hit me, I go, I don't have that. That's ridiculous. But what you don't know at an unconscious level, your brain has spent a lot of energy constructing this thing called ego to develop a story about yourself that defends you against these negative emotions. The key issue is that you can't take your survival physiology personally. It encompasses every cell of your body. It feels like who you are. It's what you have to take care of yourself and defend yourself and protect you, but it's not who you are. Who you are is separate from this survival physiology. So there's a gift of Schadenfreude, is that, okay, it's a reaction. I don't have to take it personally. I can feel it, acknowledge it, but it's a feeling. It's a feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to do anything. So I learned to be with the feeling, quit reacting to it, quit fighting it. I feel like I've been let out of jail. There's a tremendous amount of mental energy freed up to say, okay, I've got Schadenfreude. Big deal. But the gift of it is that a major aspect of solving repetitive thought patterns is separating your identity from your survival physiology. So Schadenfreude is a very distinct reaction. You can look at it as a very clear definition. That's my survival physiology. It's part of actually in the big picture every day, recognizing survival physiology versus who you are. So envy is the starting point, because the greater the envy, which lights up pain circuits directly, the Schadenfreude decreases the pain. So the greater the envy, the greater the Schadenfreude.
Give me an example. It can be made up.
I'll just tell you about my situation right now. So I had a major suicidal depression. I went to a spine fellowship that's considered almost number one in the world. Almost everybody in that fellowship went on to be chairmen of departments, international figures, etc. And I couldn't do that. I was trying to stay alive. So, you know, am I envious of those people? Yes. Am I happy about my 15 years in hell? No. And historically, I could think about that a lot. My mind would race, poor me, I didn't do this, this, and this. It's done. It's over. There's nothing I can do. So when one of those people fails, what happens?
You probably feel better about your own situation.
Well, it's even deeper than that. It's just flat out. So that's true. Intellectually, that's true because you rationalize it. You feel better about yourself. Or let's say you're going on the freeway and a car goes by at 90 miles an hour, big BMW. Obviously, this person is wealthy. Don't give a shit about life in general or being caught. They have the money to pay for it. But the person does get pulled over by a policeman 2 miles down the road. You have the twinge of, you know, this person got his just due. So that's that schadenfreude sensation, this sense of joy, because what happens in the brain, the pleasure circuits light up. So look at human behavior. So envy is a big one. I wish I had that money. I wish I had that house. I wish I had that car. When you're in chronic pain, it gets to be particularly perverse because when I was in my worst part of chronic pain, I was envious of everything everybody had. So first of all, I was envious of people not being in pain. I was envious of people being happy. I was envious that they had families and things that I didn't have. So when you're in the deep hole, what I call the abyss, the envy never stops, right? I mean, everybody has more than you do. You start feeling like your situation's special. Nobody has it worse than me. So it's a pure victim role. And so the envy is as deep as it goes. So when I don't want to say this on the air, but there's one major public figure who I was just obsessively envious of, had everything. I won't even mention what he had or didn't have, but he committed suicide about 10 years ago. And going, oh my God. Now, and that wasn't a schadenfreude reaction. I just was blown away. I remember in Sun Valley, when I lived there for 4 years, there was, remember, ruminating thoughts are directly linked to suicide. And sometimes the better you have it in life, you don't know what else to do to escape your thoughts. And we all know these superstars that keep committing suicide. And you go, well, what's going on here? Well, you cannot erase your thoughts. Well, as in Sun Valley, there were 6 males between ages 45 and 60 who committed suicide. They had families, houses, money, beautiful place to live. 6 of them in 18 months committed suicide. Now, I don't know what was in their heads, but from a physical standpoint, they certainly had everything. And it's a pretty high chance that they had these ruminating thought patterns. And lots of things drive it, but that self-critical voice is actually, I think, a form of schadenfreude. But I want to, so let me go to the third part of it, which is the most critical, which really dictates human behavior. So you have envy, which all of us have. It comes in the form of FOMO, which I have it as much as anybody. We have all this opportunity. We feel like we're missing out on this, this, and this. We need more friends, more experiences, more money, whatever it is. So FOMO is pretty prevalent in this day and age. And so then you can actually try to be grateful for what you have, but it doesn't work. In other words, you can't intellectually solve the same because you're in mental pain. There's no protection from mental pain. And when you feel schadenfreude, you witness other people suffering, you actually have less pain. So I just want to stop for a second. Let me go one more step. So the third step is called tall poppy syndrome. If somebody is more successful than you, came out of Australia, in egalitarian societies where equality is sort of emphasized, when somebody becomes too prominent, they get cut down or bullied, whatever it is. So I'll never forget the story of Shaq O'Neal in high school being bullied. I'm going, are you kidding me? I mean, the last person you really think would be bullied would be Shaq O'Neal.
Shaquille, right? The basketball player.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he's a huge guy, obviously competent, incredible athlete, nice person. Why would he be bullied? Well, he's a tall poppy, literally. Mm-hmm. That's a pun intended, I guess. But I mean, anybody that stands out in any realm or considered a competition. So if you don't get enough pain relief from observing someone else's suffering, you inflict it yourself.
That's bullying, bullies.
Bullying, but what about gossip?
Yeah.
Let's try gossip.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we gossip? All of us do it. We're taking somebody else down. We're taking away their reputation. And in the Jewish religion, evil speech is considered worse than murder, called Lashon Hara. And the thing is, you're taking away somebody's reputation. You're cutting them down. You're, quote, making yourself better. But again, it's more than intellectual. You actually get that surge of pleasure in your brain. Those pleasure circuits light up.
How does this, because I feel like this comes in waves for people. Like my, for instance, my daughter, she's a tween, and it's this period of life for her seems like it's starting to become filled with this stuff, the gossip and all that. And trying to think back to me when I was that age, it felt like that progressed and progressed and progressed through teen years, and then probably about 17 it really tapered off. And then when you're in your 20s, people don't really care. But then when you get into like your, you know, late 20s, early 30s, you kind of start looking around at other people that, you know, maybe you've known forever that either have it better than you or whatever. What's up with the waves on that?
I have to disagree on that.
Okay.
I think it comes in waves for a given person, mm-hmm. but I don't think you generalize the time period. I mean, the research shows that 93% of kids that are 8 years old have obsessive thought patterns, and it's usually around safety. And then 27% of those kids have obsessive thought patterns to the point they're actually disruptive and disturbing. So look at the human experience. Look at domestic violence. I mean, in my family, there's four of us, three boys and a girl. And my mother was always abusive. But when my sister was born, it was unbelievable what she did. And we were sort of joking about this mother-daughter thing. But, I mean, she was called ugly and stupid. Drat the day you were born. I mean, just never stopped. But my sister was beautiful. And my mother, I guess, clearly looked at her as competition. And so also in families, what I found out, we'll talk about family dynamics on another day, but in a family, I thought when somebody healed from chronic pain, and the healings are profound, that the families would rejoice, right? They never do. They pull people right back into the hole. It's unbelievable. Because that person's successful, it calls them out about what they're not doing. It changes the control versus being controlled situation. It changes the family dynamics. And families, it took me 5 years to figure this out. I swear to God, families resist change to the deepest degree. Mm-hmm. Keeps you right in the pain factor. Conversely, if I understand the rules of the family dynamics, yes, you can use it equally as powerfully to pull people out of the hole. But let me just sit back. I'm going to get your impression of this because I'm just sort of blown away. If you look at the human experience, okay, all of us are trapped by our thoughts to some degree. We don't know how to escape them. And one way to decrease our pain is to actually watch other people's suffering or inflict it. That's the human experience.